protagonists to experiment within factitious environments, not just as if they were factual, but because, from a purely descriptive point of view, they were. I'm going to say that this sense of entitlement came from no one more than from Radcliffe's contemporary, Joseph Priestley. But before leaving her behind entirely, I'd like to underscore the potentially creative and affirmative way her air elucidates an opaque but inevitable medium from within it. The air that Radcliffe's presumably French and Italian heroines breathe is never English air, and as the blue tinge of it suffuses her famed landscapes, it also encodes what critics call the softer graces of the non-English-speaking landscape painters, like Poussin and Claude Lorrain, whom Radcliffe is supposed to have copied with her pen. In both cases, Radcliffe's air visibly marks the place of English lexical mediation. It makes apparent, in other words, that Radcliffe's improbably English-speaking heroines really aren't breathing French or Italian air, and that we are reading a modern English novel, not looking at an old French painting. Ariel's citations in such instances serve to make the facts and elements of mediation apparent as a condition of experience, even as they signal the literal composition of Radcliffean fiction, words printed in movable type on pages to produce an impression of English. What's more, Radcliffe's fixed yet volatile forms of air animate the classic predicament of Gothic heroines trapped in worlds constructed in and through media. If anything, her aerial forms compound their predicament with that of Radcliffe's own reader. There is literally no difference between the kinds of air that her female characters breathe, listen to, write about, physically shape with their lutes and vocal... vocal cords, mistake for ghosts, fight to keep breathing. There's no meaningful difference between the kind of air about them and the kind that we are reading about. Here it's possible to see how something we can call literary atmosphere could arise from the recombinant, artificial, and self-consciously superficial field of letters. We can also begin to imagine, if not see, how people like Coleridge and Scott, readers of Radcliffe, could begin writing about atmosphere in this sense, and how novelists like Bulwer-Lytton or Dickens or even Jane Austen, who sends up five unironic umbrellas at least in Northanger Abbey, could begin manufacturing it for themselves. If nothing else, the reflexive literariness of Radcliffe's air realizes these developments and helps us to realize how they came about through the material of the literary medium. So that's the literary part. I'll move on to Priestley quickly. So I believe I will call Radcliffe's air fixed air. It's fixed, that is, into rigid, superficial forms that the novelist reflexively arranges and rearranges to register and, through its effects, examine a de facto literary environment. Fixed air, though, is also a term pertaining to the environment. It's what 18th century pneumatic chemists called carbon dioxide, and they had only recently isolated and analyzed it as one of the components of the common air we all breathe. The very notion that common air has components took decades to diffuse and be absorbed. But in 1774, Priestley's experiments and observations on different kinds of air catalyzed this process. Experiments and observations begins with Priestley wandering past a brewery and bath and noticing the bubbles that seethe in its vats. Thrilled by this discovery, the chemist goes on to employ an air pump to induce... this is what he used, right? An air pump to induce effervescence artificially. He then experiments in the same manner with putrescence, evaporation, inflammation, combustion, and via such forced effects, he is able to identify what amount to 14 different kinds of air. These factitious airs, so called to distinguish them from common air, turn out to be all there is to air itself, though for us to be able to live in, through, and with it, only one seems to be strictly required. Oxygen, which for reasons I'll get into later, Priestley called vital or dephlogisticated air. It was with, it is a joke, you're right to laugh. It was with fixed air, though, that Priestley was most positively and frequently associated in his own day. One reason was that bubbles of fixed air were relatively visible, and they were certainly ubiquitous. Once people knew what to look for, fixed air started showing up all over the place. Being in Germany in the summer of the year 1774, Priestley himself recalled, he happened to pass by a famous spring of seltzer water, and here he observed a bubbling of air exactly similar to that in the bath waters. Fixed air bubbles up in Radcliffe's writing. Her 1795 travelogue of her tour to the German states but devotes pages to a side trip to quote Selters, which under the name of Seltzer is so celebrated throughout Europe for its medicinal water. Here, Radcliffe mixed Seltzer water with Rhenish wine and sugar and found that, quote, the acid of the wine, expelling the fixed air of the other ingredients, occasions an effervescence like that of champagne. The novelist supposed that, quote, the danger of drinking carbonated water is that the acid may be too powerful for some constitutions. What made this acid so threatening to some constitutions? One thing is that it reveals all constitutions to be just that, constituted of elements that are, in Priestley's phrase, exactly similar from constitution to constitution. What is the difference between a German cocktail and, say, French champagne? Between Selters and Seltzer? Between the bubbling of air in a German spring and the same thing in a vat in Bath? Between bubbling and bubbles? Between the experiments and observations of a respected chemist and a travelogue by a best-selling novelist? Both Radcliffe and Priestley raised these suddenly difficult questions within the interchangeable elements of the English print medium. But at the level of those typographical elements, how English, really? More broadly speaking, Radcliffe and Priestley both experimented with fixed air in the scientific environment of the so-called chemical revolution, a revolution not incidentally ignited by pneumatic investigations like Priestley's. The two writers also shared a revolutionary socio-political environment. Priestley's preface to Experiments and Observations famously threatened that, quote, the English hierarchy, if there be anything unsound in its constitution, has equal reason to tremble even at an air pump. As Isaac Kramnik pointed out, Priestley's abelian and discriminating chemistry, based on multitudes of exactly similar kinds dispersed the world over, supplied a metaphorical model for a rising universal and democratic political vision. By definition, though, Priestley's atmospheric figures also turned out to express the threat that this same vision posed to fixed political constitutions, constitutions that Priestley himself painted as part of, quote, a Gothic feudal system now vanishing like an enchanted castle in a romance. Thus Burke, the wild gas, the fixed air, is plainly broke loose, he warned in 1790 of the revolution in France. William Pitt also anxiously marked the effervescence of the public mind at that time. Burke was the one to recommend that we, quote, suspend our judgment until the effervescency is a little subsided, till the liquor is clearer, until we see something deeper than the agitation of the troubled and frothy surface. But Priestley took little interest in anything deeper. In fact, scientifically speaking, there wasn't anything deeper than the frothy surface. His work assumed and displayed the integrity of froth, of effervescency itself, and only thus, by way of its active effects, that of fixed air. That's why Samuel Johnson ruled that Priestley must have been, quote, an evil man, sir. His work unsettles everything. Most obviously, Priestley's work on air unsettled everything, in part because he held that the singular physico-mechanical body to which Robert Boyle had ascribed the equally singular name of air was nothing but a composite of many different gases or airs. From this point of view, there is no air at all in Priestley's experiments and observations. There are just different kinds of air. Air itself, as a unified material body, does not exist except as a linguistic placeholder, a reference ticket, as disciples of Thomas Kuhn like to say. Priestley himself knew what it meant to hold up such a ticket. There are, he maintained, very few maxims in philosophy that have laid firmer hold on the mind than that air is a simple elementary substance, indestructible and inalterable. Revolting against this mind-gripping maxim, he pronounced himself satisfied that atmospherical air is not an inalterable thing, or even any one thing at all. It was in consequence of living for some time in the neighborhood of a public brewery, a little after midsummer in 1767, that I was induced to make experiments on fixed air, of which there is always a large body ready formed on the surface of the fermenting liquor. So begins his story of how Priestley began to play with the turbulent surface that is fixed air. It's hard not to hear echoes of Horace Walpole's then-recent Castle of Otranto, since that romance was structured entirely around the scattered pieces of a very large body. For his part, Priestley sets the midsummer scene of pneumatic experiment in a manner which perfectly expresses his challenge from within it to the large body ready formed of English knowledge of the air up to that time. What idiom could contain or transmit something which turned out to exist only, if at all, as a composition of different and yet infinitely interchangeable kinds. Here, the shadow of Otranto begins to seem other than incidental.